You can hear performance today at 1 o'clock this afternoon and again this evening at 8 p.m. on 102.1 WMUK from Western Michigan University, online at WMUK.org. It's 7 minutes after 10 o'clock. Our forecast calling for a mix of sun and clouds today with highs in the mid-40s. It's currently 37 degrees in Kalamazoo. This morning, my guests are conductor Andrew Kohler and violin soloist, well, viola soloist Junqing Lin, who will be appearing on the next Kalamazoo Philharmonia concert Sunday at 4 o'clock at Kalamazoo College in the Dalton Theater of the Light Fine Arts Building. Welcome, Andrew, and welcome, Junqing.
Thanks for having us.
Well, I'm very glad to have you here to chat about this concert. Junqing, you and I have talked before, but let's reintroduce you to my listeners this morning. You're assistant concertmaster at the Atlanta Symphony
Orchestra.
That
is correct.
But for 30-plus years?
This is actually my 30th season. I'm starting my 30th season this year with the Atlanta Symphony.
And amazing. And has it been that long that you've been friends with faculty members, Renata Knifick, Bruce Uchimura, and Susan Uchimura?
I've actually been friends with them longer than that. We met at a summer camp. Well, Bruce and I met at a summer camp in the early 80s, and then we taught at summer camps together in the mid-80s and 90s and 2000s. So I've been friends with them, and I've been coming to Kalamazoo on and off for about 5 years, I think. And I've been lucky enough to meet a lot of different community members, and one of the people I've been lucky enough to meet is Andrew Kohler.
So you got to meet him. When did you hear the Kalamazoo Philharmonia? Were you first hired to play with the with the Philharmonia?
I think Andrew asked me to play Prokofiev First Violin Concerto 2 years ago. I can't remember.
Something
3 years
like that. Yeah.
3 years ago, and I was lucky enough to play with them then. And I've been coming, as I said, on and off to the KSO to play guest concertmaster, and I'm fortunate to be here for all the symphonic series this year during their music director search. So it's a very interesting time to play with the KSO.
So, Andrew, this looked like a great idea for you, I'm sure, to bring
him
back to
the K-Phil. Oh, it was incredible. I mean, he's being very modest by saying, you know, he's been lucky enough, but we're the lucky ones. And it's just a beautiful thing that this friendship with those faculty members at the Western Michigan University School of Music that you mentioned, this friendship led to Kalamazoo kind of being on the map for Junqing, and he's come and he's played with the KSO, and that was the entry point for all kinds of other projects. So it's been just a real delight to have him in town and to try and take advantage of it as much as possible. I'm trying to, you know, use him up for everything we can.
Well, and I think, Carrie, you didn't mention that Andrew is playing the violin, not just conducting at the K-Phil concert on Sunday. And so I think he's stepping outside of his comfort zone, which is
God help us all. Yeah.
Yes. Very, very important for conductors to do. And so Andrew is a really good violinist, and he needs to showcase his talents more, I think.
This is something I can imagine that we want to see, the orchestra wants to see, and Andrew would prefer a baton in his hands.
That's entirely accurate. Actually, Junqing and I played a preview performance of this with piano accompaniment only, mostly at my request because I wanted a chance to go through it in a concert setting. And in the introduction to that concert, I pointed out that, you know, I was probably supposed to be conducting. Junqing is a wonderful violinist, and here he is playing the viola. So, you know, really, set expectations low. I mean, this is nobody's doing what they're supposed to be doing here. We're all just stretching ourselves.
Well, there must be a small element of, if I have to do it, well, then so does he. and you know, you need to put your money where your mouth is.
Fair enough, yes.
As a soloist. And to hear you express musicality through an instrument will be really rewarding, I think.
The dirty secret is that it's a great joy. It really is. And as nerve-wracking as it might be for me, because it's not something that I do as frequently anymore, it's really an awful lot of fun to get back to those roots, those musical roots, to do that again. And then most of all, to get to play with someone like Junqing, which is just... you know, this is the piece itself, too, I can't imagine a more successful, a more rewarding vehicle for a project like this.
There must be other violin, viola, plus orchestra pieces out there, but I could see why you'd keep coming back to the Sinfonia Concertante by Mozart.
Yeah. There's actually not a significant number of violin, viola concerti. Yeah. I know Benjamin Britten wrote something. Mm-hmm. I'm drawing a blank on anything
I think
else.
Martinu did.
Yeah, Martinu wrote that.
Oh, there you go.
A bunch of duos, madrigals, you know. So
for sure,
nice,
for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, there is some repertoire out there, but with orchestra, it's pretty limited. And then you contrast that limited repertoire with the fact that this is surely one of Mozart's most inspired creations. Yeah. And that's really an incredible thing because, I mean, Mozart was never anything less than inspired. So, you know, to be, in my estimation, and I think in Chen Qing's as well, in the top ranks of some of his works, that's really an elevated sphere to be in.
What do we know about where Mozart was in his life and career when he was writing this piece?
Well, I think one of the extraordinary things about it is that it represents a kind of turning point for him. He's a young man at this point. He's 23 years old, and it's written in 1779. And in 1779, he was traveling around Europe. Now, he had done this, of course, many times as the famed child prodigy of his age, so he'd already been around Europe lots. But this trip was a little different. On the one hand, this trip was like those young trips in that he was always this brilliant sponge for regional styles. He goes anywhere, he hears what is faddish in one place or the other and figures out how to incorporate. And that's, in a lot of ways, the sort of most simple genesis of the Sinfonia Concertante. That is to say, he visited Mannheim, he visits Paris. Paris loves the Sinfonia Concertante as a form, which is sort of a mix of, you know, this larger symphonic kind of playing, but with multiple virtuoso lines and quite extensive. So he grabs hold of this thing. He thinks, all right, I can do something with this. And then he also spends time in Mannheim, and sure enough, somewhat unusually for Mozart, there's this long building crescendo in the introduction, orchestral introduction to this work, which was one of the hallmarks of the court orchestra in Mannheim. So again, he hears something, he thinks that's effective, that's great. He figures out how to incorporate it seamlessly into his own language. But unlike his earlier travels, there's some other things that sort of touched on his time. One was that his mother passed away suddenly, unexpectedly. And the other was that he was trying very hard to find new work. He wanted out of Salzburg desperately. He was working in the shadow of his father, and both were employed by the Archbishop of Salzburg. Mozart felt underappreciated there. He had to play the violin there a lot. He didn't like doing that. And he wanted out. So he was looking for work. And the work wasn't successful, but unfortunately, he didn't find a job in either of those places, Paris or Mannheim. But I think one of the end results was that he pushed himself ever farther as a composer to establish him as a mature artist, as his own artist. And I think in a lot of ways, this piece does exactly that. It kind of signals that he's arrived. And even in a sense, some people think that, you know, the second movement, which we can perhaps even listen to a little bit, is really tinged with tragedy, unusually by Mozart. And some commentators have suspected this might have something to do with his mother's death. And even his choice of the viola to pair with the violin, you know, he had one of those overbearing fathers who said, oh, Wolfgang, if you only applied yourself, imagine what you could do with the violin. But he much preferred playing the viola. So people suspect that at the premiere performance of this, he would have played the viola. And he even does something with the viola to make it kind of rival the violin in brilliance, which I also think of as a sort of subtle rebuke to the Archbishop and to his father, which maybe Chen Qing can explain because, purist that he is, he's planning to do it exactly as Mozart intended.
Well, I think in another example of Mozart playing chess when everybody's playing checkers, he writes the viola part. The piece is in E-flat, but he writes the viola part in D major for the viola tuned up half a step. So most performances that you'll hear of this piece now, the violist just plays it in E-flat. But he had the idea, and especially with the instruments of the time, with the gut strings that they had, they didn't have the metal strings that we have now that project a lot more than the animal gut strings that they used. That added half step adds a certain kind of edge and brilliance to the viola. I said to Andrew, it sounds like it's an alien instrument, actually, when you play it in this tuning. And I've never had the opportunity to do this. I played both the violin parts and the viola parts in E flat. But I'd always been curious, because I'd never actually heard a performance where the violist played it with the viola tuned up half a step. So I said, well, if I'm not going to hear one, I might as well create one. And when Andrew asked me to play with the K-Phil, I thought of all the different vanity projects that I wanted to do, and this is one of them. And so, and knowing Andrew, having played some chain music with Andrew and having played with him in the KSO, I knew he was a good enough violinist. So I said, hey, you know, this would be good for all of us. So it's an interesting, it's very interesting. It's very different. It's very playing with your instrument tuned up half a step, which is called scordatura, or out of tune, essentially, is really an interesting process. And I think I'm fortunate that I don't have perfect pitch, so I don't have the association of seeing a note and expecting to hear a certain pitch. But it's still a little disconcerting or nerve-wracking to participate in, but it's part of the whole experience.
The part you are reading has two sharps on it. It's in D.
It does. It's in D major. Yeah.
Does it make it a whole different part for you?
It's very interesting. I said to Andrew the other day that actually, parts of it, when you play the viola part in E flat, there are certain parts that you actually can't play without alteration. So playing the part in D major allows you to play them naturally, but there are actually certain things that are, when you play it scordatura, there's all these open E flats that you could use, and open strings are kind of an anathema to string players now. We expect to cover open strings a lot more than we used to. I think back in Mozart's time, they would have just played them as open mm-hmm. strings.
It's a bonus.
And so it actually makes the part a little bit more difficult in certain ways.
Avoid the sympathetic strings coming in?
Yeah, well, and also having certain pitches that when you play a string instrument, you're used to sympathetic vibrations on certain pitches, yeah. And that doesn't happen for the pitches I expect it to happen for. So, it's a mind-bending kind of process. So everybody can come watch the freak show on Sunday.
Let's remind everyone that's at 4 o'clock on Sunday at the Dalton Theater of the Light Fine Arts Center at Kalamazoo College. And why don't we listen to one of the movements? I'll let you pick, Andrew.
Slow movement sounds great.
Yeah,
sorry,
we had talked
Andrew,
about doing that slow movement. So, yeah, let's take a listen to that.
just a few measures of the third movement. If you tuned in during the music, that's from Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante for violin and viola soloists with orchestra. And we were listening to illustrate some of the things conductor and violinist Andrew Kohler was talking about, along with violist in this case, Junqing Lin. Both will be appearing on Sunday with the Kalamazoo Philharmonia at 4 o'clock to perform the Sinfonia Concertante. And I was the one who at last minute insisted that we hear a little of the third movement so that sort of remind listeners and myself that even though there's a dark heart to this piece, what I have always come away with, my overall impression, is just joy and elegance.
As is often the case in Mozart. And I think this is so important. I'm really glad you brought this up because that was a real classical ideal, right? That kind of balance, that even if you feel something very strongly, that there's a sort of countervailing balance to that. And so, yes, indeed, the outer movements are much sunnier, much livelier. You even think, for example, at the end of Don Giovanni, right? I mean, that's got one of the darkest endings in music. I mean, the main character is pulled down into the depths of hell, and the music is imperious, terrifying. And then afterwards, and the Romantics actually tended to cut this from performances of Don Giovanni, there's a final little ensemble number where everyone runs on stage and sings a happy little ditty that says, see, that's what happens when you're a terrible person. But it's this classical ideal of restoring balance and order. And that kind of brings me to the whole theme of this program, why Mozart and the Strauss, the Alpine Symphony that we're about to start discussing, are paired together. And that is the idea of nature. You see, the classical philosophy would have invoked the ideal of nature as a kind of a perfection to be pursued. And the way that nature was realized in their music was this very idea of rationality and balance and all things in order, all things in proportion. It was the same thing that was going through architecture, through all the arts. It was, again, once more, like the Renaissance, sort of looking back to ancient Greece and saying, oh, everything was so perfect then. Let's aim for that. And then the Romantics tended to look at nature in a very different way, again, a very personal way. So rather than the universal, it became something for the individual to be able to find renewal, spiritual renewal in. And that's very much the approach to nature that Richard Strauss uses in his final tone poem, actually, an Alpine Symphony. I'm not really sure why he chose the title an Alpine Symphony. It's deeply misleading. It is not a symphony. It is definitely a tone poem, but for whatever reason, he decided to tack on that word symphony.
Length?
Yeah, maybe, but there's certainly other tone poems he didn't call symphonies that are as long as this one. Maybe there was some sense of the thoroughness of the investigation. But really, there's nothing about it that feels like a symphony. It really is just a series of connected episodes. And really, the fundamental definition of a tone poem is that this is an orchestral work that gets its inspiration from some extra musical source. Could be literary, could be the natural world, as it is in this case. Although there are some literary inspirations here, too. The interesting thing about this Alpine Symphony is that it is one of the longest gestating works for Strauss. He was kind of a pretty efficient guy most of the time. You know, he would sit down, he'd do what he needed to do. And he was as a composer as he is as a conductor. And if you've ever seen a video of him conducting, it's unbelievably economical. I mean, there's a hilarious story of him, you know, sort of conducting with these minute, you know, 1-inch movements, apparently checking his watch and then slightly speeding up the speed of his those minute movements because he thought, oh, let's get on with it already. I mean, he was just he famously said that a conductor should never break a sweat in the orchestra. I mean, that you're doing it wrong if you're ever winding yourself that much. Of course, his music, despite his let me say clinical approach or efficiency in composing music usually is of course full of emotion. It's just the opposite of what you would expect. But this particular work, which is certainly in that vein, really took a long time. He grew up in Bavaria. He moved back to Bavaria later in his life. He built a villa in Garmisch-Partenkirchen, and he loved that landscape. He loved the alpine landscape more than anything else. I think that signaled home for him. And as even a teenager, he climbed a mountain. He would climb the Alps, and he had experiences like getting caught in a rainstorm that actually inspired some musical ideas. So the very first sketches, I don't know if the actual sketches made it into this final version, but the very first musical ideas for this piece started when he was 15 years old. And then as he goes through life, as an adult, he falls under the spell of Nietzsche, for example. And one of the things that he really was fascinated by was Nietzsche's writing on Christianity. He sort of, there's a later work by Nietzsche that sort of decries Christian morality. What Strauss took away from that was, well, if we were to turn away from organized religion, then where would what would be the place where we would direct our spiritual longings? And for him, the answer was nature. And that connected to that teenage self, those experiences of being on the mountain. And then the final catalyst was Mahler's death. Mahler sought spiritual renewal on his own terms, but he venerated nature no less than Strauss. And so with his passing, that was the final impetus for Strauss to say, this piece has been bubbling in my subconscious in some form or another for decades now. Now is the time to complete it. And that's what finally brought him to finishing what would end up being his very last tone poem. And that is this Alpine Symphony. It's an incredible achievement.
Strauss died around 1949.
He said famously at the end of his life, I've outlived even myself. He lived so long. I mean, can you imagine? He was coming of age in the late 19th century. You know, Mahler dies in 1911, and that was a close friend, really, you know, compatriot. And here he is finally passing away after World War II. Just how unimaginably the world had changed by that point.
I imagine anyone whose lifespan encompassed two world wars would be thinking, I have outlived my life.
Yeah.
So this is much more than an appreciation of the landscape and wilderness and the peace and comfort it can bring.
That's exactly right. And you know, one even gets a hint of that if he reads through these. There are 22 continuous episodes, little movements, and many of them seem like, oh, sure, it's night, it's the sunrise, and
here's birdsong.
Yes, exactly, right. Yeah, here we are climbing up the mountain. He even has titles like The Ascent, but then there are these mysterious titles like Apparition or Vision or Elegy, and you think, well, those aren't normal things on a mountain climb, I don't think, but maybe they could be, I don't know. And you start to suspect that there's more going on here. And sure enough, the more closely you listen, the more you know about this background that I was describing, the more you realize that, yes, on the surface, this is just about a 12-hour mountain climb up and down a mountain, but it resonates with much more profound things about fear of mortality, about limitations and possibilities that we have as human beings, what we can do for ourselves, and, as Strauss himself put it, the worship of eternal, magnificent nature.
Did Strauss consider Mahler an equal, a peer, or was Mahler somehow greater in his estimation than himself?
I think the words that the kids would use these days would be frenemy. So they were definitely colleagues, friends. They respected one another, and yet they felt a keen rivalry with one another. Mahler was quoted as saying, speaking of mountains, it feels like we're both trying to burrow through a mountain from the opposite ends. You know, we're like getting at the same thing, but we're doing it with very different means. Mahler, of course, famously only composed symphonies, where here was Strauss composing no symphonies, always using the tone poem. Mahler started with some programmatic material, that is to say, this extra musical associations to his music, and then decided later, no, I don't want that stuff. I just want pure abstraction. Whereas Strauss always wanted to hang his hat on something more literal and turned much more to opera later in his career. But they used similar orchestras, and they both had great respect for one another.
This Alpine Symphony is on the program on Sunday at 4 o'clock. And Andrew Kohler, my guest here, will be conducting, also playing with Junqing Lin, the Mozart Sinfonia Concertante. Sounds like a really exciting program. So where shall we begin? At the very beginning?
Let's begin at the beginning. That's a great spot. This is Night, and is where we begin and end this tone poem. And it's an incredible effect that Strauss uses. It's just a simple downward scale, each pitch of which is sustained after it's sounded. And so you get a cluster of seven notes, a rather modern gesture for a composer who was not prone to getting too modern. But the beauty is that it creates this veil, this darkness. It's a perfect evocation of night.
Holding my breath, Andrew Kohler. This is music from the Alpine Symphony by Richard Strauss, but we can't really technically call it a symphony. This is a tone poem and a journey, which starts off in a pretty dramatic form, I must say.
Yeah, that's an incredible evocation of a sunrise, you know, and we start again with that scale in the dark of night. And he builds so slowly, so masterfully. He joked apparently after the first rehearsal of this piece, which requires absurd amounts of personnel on stage, by the way, that he had, quote, finally learned to orchestrate here in his final tone poem.
By putting everyone on
exactly,
the stage?
By just using everybody. And you know, there was this sort of fad for real literalism in his orchestration. What I mean by that is that there's a passage later, for example, where we're meant to be on the alpine pasture, and sure enough, to make sure that we get the sense just right, he asks for cowbells, real cowbells, alpine cowbells, to be inserted into the percussion section. And then still later, there's a storm scene where he actually asks for a wind machine, this great contraption that pulls a piece of canvas across a wheel and that sounds just like howling winds. So, you know, he wasn't content merely to use instruments to imitate these ideas, but he actually wanted to get as close as he could to the real effect.
What we would call them sound effects.
Right, exactly. I mean, they really are, and it's quite stunning.
Do you have a wind machine?
We, thanks to the theater department at Kalamazoo College, have a wind machine. Yes, we really do. We have built one. Amazingly, I talked to John Reeves, who's this incredible technical director of the theater at the Festival Playhouse at Kalamazoo College, and I said, "Hey, I've got a crazy idea." And somehow he said, "Oh yeah, I've already built one of those before. No problem." Just came up with a wind machine for us. Amazing.
Well, if that's really what you want to see, the concert is at 4 on Sunday at the Dalton Theater of the Light Fine Arts Center, and you'll get an awful lot of brilliant Strauss along with the wind machine and the Sinfonia Concertante of Mozart. It's at 4 o'clock, and there's more information at the Kalamazoo Philharmonia website. I am in mind of another big Strauss piece that wasn't played too long ago. It was Ein Heldenleben, or A Hero's mm-hmm. Life. I talked to Raymond Harvey about the piece, and he told the story of this tone poem, which is basically the hero is the composer. Mm-hmm. There are moments where he faces off with critics, both pompous and bitter, and then the great love-hate push-pull of his life is his wife, mm-hmm. as represented by violin.
Right.
So I'm wondering if he used a similar approach and gave a certain instrument or a certain solo part to represent something significant in this tone poem.
Well, I wouldn't say there's anything as extensive as the violin solo in Heldenleben, anything like that. But I do think there's another portion we could listen to, which would be a great part to listen to anyway. And that's, after we've made our ascent and gone through a bunch of different landscapes, like the pasture that I mentioned, and a waterfall, we eventually, of course, reach the peak, which is written in such a way as to be the climax of the work. But the way he treats it is really, I think, quite ingenious. That is to say, there is a lot of grandeur in that moment, of course. But just before that happens, right when we reach the peak, instead he just has, against the thinnest sort of backdrop, just sort of trembling strings, he has a lone oboe solo. And the solo is rather unusual. It's kind of almost stuttering, perhaps. It almost seems overwhelmed, gasping for air, not sure of what to make of this achievement of having reached the summit. And I think in some sense also feels somehow the insignificance of herself, or as a lone voice against the magnificence of nature around her. It's a really beautiful moment, and particularly in a piece that requires such large forces and has so many sonorous, rich climaxes, as Strauss is wont to do. It's an especially effective moment, I think, to sort of strip all that away and then just leave this one voice there.
Oh, that sounds very human.
Yes.
Sometimes we're exactly. really not up to the task of taking in something so spectacular as an alpine view.
Precisely. Yeah. And I think that's exactly what he's going for. So I think that, you know, we hear here a little introduction to the summit, one that's called Gefahrvolle Augenblicke. This means sort of like dangerous views. So you can hear a lot of tension in the music as he's getting his way up to the summit. But then finally we arrive, and then the oboe solo I described.
Hard to pull away in a moment of ecstasy at the top of a mountain in the Alps, the Alpine Symphony of Richard Strauss. If you tuned in during that pinnacle of a moment, it goes on for another bit of the journey back down the mountain to evening again.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, do you have any final things to say and
well,
appeal
I thought
to?
I thought I'd mention quickly that Jun Qing, who's the viola soloist in the Mozart, is very generously agreed to help us out in the violin section as well, which is an incredible, incredible thing to have someone of his expertise, someone who's done this piece a bunch of times with a world-class orchestra, kind of helping us out and giving us a little advice. So we're really pressed him into service this time.
Well, I brought my viola to the back of the section, but it was tuned incorrectly, so it was not of any use.
So. Yeah, so we had to switch him to the violin. Yeah, we had no choice. It was the only.
No, it's fun to play a piece that I've played a number of times, as Andrew mentioned, with a great symphony orchestra, and to play it with people that are experiencing it for the first time is always exciting for me, and is a good reminder of why you get into music in the first place. And so I'm happy that he allows me to sit in the back and disrupt the back because I'm used to sitting in the front. And I like sitting in the front more, by the way. But anyway, it's a lot of fun to sit among the students and, like I said, experience it. And Andrew's pretty good as a conductor, so.
Yes, he is.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, there's a lot of great music happening this weekend, but this one's also unmissable. So I hope you have a really, really rewarding concert as musicians and, of course, for all the listeners who will be attending. That's at 4 o'clock in the Light Fine Arts Center at Kalamazoo College on Sunday.
Yeah.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks, Dunqing.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.